You are listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. Views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au.
We acknowledge and pay our respects to the Kaurna people, the traditional custodians whose ancestral land we gather on. We acknowledge the deep feelings of attachment and relationship of the Kaurna people to country, and we respect and value their past, present, and ongoing connection to the land and cultural beliefs. I've got a little poem by Heather K. Januels. We come this day called by war, by the suffering we inflict and endure when minds across borders fail to reason and compromise. We come this day called by loss, the deaths of those who serve in our name, those whose lives end before their natural course, in service to a cause greater than their own. We come this day called by hope, hope that we will in some season finally surrender our swords for plowshares. And we come this day called by peace. May we hear its song. May we proclaim its promise. May our remembrance today renew our struggle. We can never stay or rest. Welcome to this place made holy by our presence. It is rooted in love, inspired by wisdom, nourished by hope, grounded in our seven principles, fed by our traditions and grown through our deeds. My name's Jenny Dyster, the lay leader of this spiritual community. No matter how you identify yourself or who you love, you're welcome here. These are our agreements: to dwell together in peace, to seek the truth in love, and to help one another. After our service, please stay for tea, coffee, and conversation if you don't have a pressing engagement. You are all welcome. And today's first hymn is on your hymn sheet. Has everyone got one? Aran, could you read the words for us? Because it's a little Hebrew.
Hevenu shalom aleichem. Hevenu shalom aleichem. Hevenu shalom aleichem va'al kol Yisrael. Without singing it, that's the Hebrew.
Just like Arabic, shalom aleichem. Assalamu alaikum. It's just like Arabic.
It's our tradition to light candles for our joys, concerns, or insights. If you choose not to share, you can still take part in widening this circle of compassion by listening with an open heart and mind. I'm going to light the first candle in remembrance for the late John Dowie, painter, sculptor, and beloved member of our church. That was the temporary grave marker. Can you see the joke on it? I've never felt better in my life. That's John, isn't it? That was at Shady Grove before the permanent marker was put in. John Dowie's statues of the Queen were on television. They're in the courtyard in Parliament House. So that will be my first candle, and after that I will invite people from the congregation to light candles. The last candle, as always, are for those thoughts that remain silent in our hearts but are nevertheless very dear to us. Today we'll have four poems about peace, and I've asked people in the congregation to read them. And the first one is by Sir Thomas Wyatt.
Sir Thomas Wyatt, I Find No Peace, written half a century before Shakespeare. Although Wyatt lived through a turbulent period of English history, which included the Reformation and the dissolution of the monasteries, this poem finds Wyatt describing his lack of inner peace and the turbulent emotions that rage in his mind. I find no peace, and all my war is done. I fear and hope, I burn and freeze like ice. I fly above the wind, yet I cannot arise. And naught I have, and all the world I season, that loseth not locketh, holdeth me in prison, and holdeth me not, yet can I scape no wise, nor letteth me live, nor die at my device, and yet of death it giveth me occasion.
I many times thought peace had come, when peace was far away, as wrecked men deem they sight the land at centre of the sea, and struggle slacker, but to prove as hopelessly as I, how many of the fictitious shores before the harbour lie. That was by Emily Dickerson. I thought many times that peace had come.
An excerpt from a poem by Alfred Noyes, On the Western Front. Writing from his experience of the devastation of World War I, he speaks from the perspective of soldiers buried in graves marked by simple crosses, asking that their deaths not be in vain. Praise of the dead was not what the dead needed, but peace made by the living. Here's the excerpt. We who lie here have nothing more to pray. To all your praises, we are deaf and blind. We may not ever know if you betray our hope to make earth better for mankind.
John Lennon, Imagine. Some of the best poems are song lyrics. John Lennon's Imagine invokes a utopia without possessions or greed, without the fighting that he believed nations and religions, by their very existence, promoted. Imagine there's no countries. It isn't hard to do. Nothing to kill or die for. And no religion, too. Imagine all the people living life in peace.
We'll now have 2 minutes of silence, and you'll hear a bell at the beginning and the end of that, and the interlude will follow. When the war in Ukraine broke out, many journalists asked, is this the start of World War III? Some feared it might be, but international outcry has been strong and fairly unified. However, it appears this is the dawn of a new Cold War with Russia pitted against the West. Some believe Putin sees the dissolution of the Soviet Union as a tragedy and intends for his legacy to be reunification. Many have drawn comparisons to Hitler's invasions of Poland and Czechoslovakia, a blatant violation of international law with no justification. As we've seen on many occasions, Putin is a seasoned liar and manipulator, and he now qualifies as a war criminal too, according to the Geneva Convention of 1949. This is what the convention document would call a war of choice. He wants a full breadbasket of the former Russian Empire, and he doesn't want a democratic Ukraine to exist. Ukraine's not a nation, in his view. The conflict has simmered on for years. It's not new. He claimed with incredible chutzpah that his objective was to denazify the country, a statement made even more offensive by the fact that the Ukrainian president is a Jew who lost relatives in the Holocaust. Putin claims this is a justified aggression, but the designation of just war has pretty much gone the way of the dodo, according to most political scientists and even among the Catholics who created the document in the first place. The notion of any war being just is a bit dodgy in my view, although wars like World War II are unavoidable, given facts and circumstances. When people and nations march off to war, it's common to believe that their cause is righteous. They're defending themselves against tyranny and God's on their side. The truth is, most laws are not just wars. We deceive ourselves into thinking our war is just, while their war is evil. Just war theory originated with Thomas Aquinas in the 13th century. It seemed like a useful idea at the time, an attempt to curtail warfare and stop evil and violence. And the criteria are strict. 1. A just war can only be waged as a last resort. 2. A war is only just if it's waged by a legitimate authority. 3. A just war can only be fought to redress a wrong suffered. 4. A war is only just if it's fought with a reasonable chance of success. 5. The ultimate goal of a just war is to re-establish peace. 6. The violence used in the war must be proportional to the injury suffered. And 7. The weapons used in the war must discriminate between combatants and non-combatants. Civilians are never permissible targets of war. Such calculus is chilling. Does any of that sound like what's happening in the Ukraine or what Putin had in mind? President Obama explained bluntly that Russia has made this move not because Ukraine posed a threat to Russia, but because Ukraine chose a path of sovereignty, self-determination, and democracy for exercising rights that should be available to all people and nations. Ukrainians now face a brutal onslaught that's killing innocents and displacing citizens. People of conscience need to loudly and clearly condemn Russia's actions and offer support for the Ukrainian people. And countries around the world are sanctioning Russia. The UN has soundly condemned Russia in the name of humanity. China won't condemn the invasion, but they won't support it, remembering how Russia backed Mongolia 70 years ago and supported India in the more recent border disputes. The ordinary peaceful citizens on both sides of this conflict will suffer the most. The Russian oligarchs will suffer a little financial pain, but they'll survive and some of them will profit. It's important to remember that all wars are wars against children. Parents in the Ukraine are sewing tags with their children's blood types into their clothing. We weep for another country being reduced to rubble, for more innocents terrified and potentially bombed out of their homes. And for what? War must stop this, but how? Is it possible? Has humankind become so addicted to armed conflict and numb to the destruction it causes? Are we simply hardwired for war? Now, writing in the Scientific American in 2018, R. Brian Ferguson asks these questions in his article entitled War is Not Part of Human Nature. Hawks and doves in this scholarly debate disagree. Some claim that roots of modern wars and genocides go back tens of thousands of years, and they've found evidence of war in 4 small-scale societies in the prehistoric period. They argue it's a form of conquest and also natural selection, with the fittest prevailing to acquire mates and resources. One evolutionary theory posits that the instinctual tendency to protect one's tribe has morphed over time into group inclinations toward xenophobia. If wars are a natural eruption of instinctive hate leading to the killing of outsiders, then we can grasp why wars continue to proliferate, including this one in Ukraine. But doves challenge this view. They argue that humans have an obvious capacity for warfare, but their brains are not hardwired to identify and kill outsiders. It was a consequence of societies expanding and becoming more complex beyond the hunter-gatherer cohort. A transition to agriculture formed the basis for the development of political states. It was a social circumstance, and it was about dominance. As we've seen through history, once established as a norm, war has the tendency to spread, with violent people replacing less violent ones, in some cases, dictatorships replacing democracies. We've seen this, we see it today, we must be a peaceful and steadfast sentry against it. As Aristotle wisely noted, it is not enough to win a war, it is more important to organise for peace. Ferguson laments that people are people. They fight and sometimes they kill. Humans have always had the capacity to make war, although he agrees with anthropologist Margaret Mead's assessment that warfare is an invention, not a biological necessity. Humans learn to make war and they can learn to make peace too. Some societies have distinct preconditions for peace, such as cross-group ties of kinship and marriage, cooperation in hunting, agriculture and food sharing. They did not succumb to warfare as a survival strategy, and peacemaking starts in your own hearts, not in the halls of the UN. Gandhi put it well when he said, "Strive to become an expert at living. Be good to those around you in concrete ways. Create an island of peace in your own life. If you do, it will spread. If enough of us do this, our islands will meet, ceasing to be islands and becoming whole continents. World peace exists literally in the actions each one of us takes in our own lives." So, is pacifism the answer? Now, you could argue that pacifism is inherently as self-defeating as a just war. Of course, we must stand up for what's right and against evil. Yes, we must advocate for peace, but sometimes an active stance requires the kind of armed defence we're seeing in Ukraine. The third way, as it's known, is non-violent resistance, the way of Martin Luther King, Gandhi and Thich Nhat Hanh, among others. It stands up to evil where it is found, but with a commitment to do so non-violently. It's just very hard to do in a world bathed in violence, especially as there are no clear steps for non-violent resistance like there are for warfare. More's the pity. How do we show the world a different and better way to harmony and peace than the way it knows? How do our principles come into play for us as Unitarian Universalists? We light candles for conflicts and catastrophes near and far. They're heartfelt, but often we just move on. And I'm not judging us. Thinking about Syria or Myanmar or Ukraine can be paralysing and numbing rather than energising and activating. The title of a recent online course forum gives that away: Empathy, Exhaustion and Social Change. Empathy plays a role in how we can connect deeply with wars like this one happening thousands of miles away from Norwood. People often define empathy as walking a mile in someone else's shoes. We'll take that literally and you'll end up a mile away from them and with their shoes. True empathy is being well grounded in your own shoes and compassion and walking alongside another, striving to centre their experience and understand their feelings. All the sermons, meditations and prayers and joys and sorrows stones in the world won't make a difference unless we take some form of action afterwards. Our sixth principle is the goal of world community with peace, liberty and justice for all. To make it real, there are dozens of organisations helping Ukraine right now. Google Help for Ukraine. You'll find many options there. Just as you do for many other trouble spots, places suffering from war, natural disasters, including those turbocharged by climate change. Now, it was common in Australia to hear that we shouldn't be expected to commit to reducing much of our reliance on fossil fuels because in the big scheme of things, our gross contribution to excess carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is peanuts in comparison to China or the US. Our per capita contribution to the problem is quite another matter. Moving on. And the disapproval from other countries has potentially very negative consequences. There is a direct connection between peace and justice. It is much easier to find peace when you feel neither hard done by because of circumstances beyond your control, nor guilty because of what you've done or what you've failed to do. We are fortunate in Australia in comparison to Ukraine. We're not at war. Or in comparison to Pakistan. Our floods are much less severe and we don't have melting glaciers plus monsoonal deluges of rain on quite that scale. But we do have remorseless flooding in Queensland. On my way down, I heard of a child had been found in a car that was washed down a creek. That's yesterday. So we do have loss of life, just not on the scale. Our last bushfire disaster made world news, not because of the loss of human life, but because of the horrific toll on our unique wildlife. An estimated 3 billion animals destroyed or displaced, and many threatened extinctions, platypus, for example. The environmental and health consequences of climate change disproportionately affect low-income countries and poor people in high-income countries. They profoundly affect human rights and social justice. Now, our government has this advice for our citizens. We recommend you set your temperature between 18 to 20. Every 1 degree centigrade higher will add 10% to your heating bill. The most efficient way to use your system is by zoning it. This allows you to split the house into different zones so that you can limit it to only heat the areas you're using. Now, that is no doubt excellent advice for the residents of Burnside and Springfield. But people in housing trusts, social housing, or the average Australian rental accommodation don't heat their houses to even 15 degrees in winter, according to a recent survey. European visitors get colder here than in their much colder homelands. Energy inefficient homes are blamed in part for higher winter death rates in Australia than in much colder countries such as Sweden. Environmental and health consequences threaten civil and political rights and economic, social and cultural rights, including right to life, access to safe food and water, health, security, shelter and culture. On a national or local level, those people who are most vulnerable to the adverse environmental and health consequences of climate change include poor people, members of minority groups, women, children, older people, people with chronic diseases and disabilities, those residing in areas with a high prevalence of climate-related diseases, and workers exposed to extreme heat or increased weather variability. On a global level, there's much inequity with low-income countries. Low-income countries produce the least greenhouse gases, but they're more adversely affected by climate change than high-income countries, which produce substantially higher amounts of greenhouse gases, yet are less immediately affected. In addition, low-income countries have far less capability to adapt to climate change than high-income countries. So what I'm suggesting now is that our future might be better served by paying attention to climate change now than by signing contracts for nuclear submarines to be delivered some decades in the future. And I'm going to finish today with a plug. Come and see Carbon, the Unauthorised Biography, here next Saturday lunchtime. We'll feed you, inform you, and even motivate you. We won't be laying guilt trips or promoting the Ain't It Awful or We'll All Be Ruined, said Hanrahan, before the day is done mindset. The film is much more positive, playful, and thought-provoking. Do come. And the final hymn today is on your hymn sheet. And it's one that John Rutter has set to music. I think you'll recognise the tune. Closing words by Jim McGaw. When I say go in peace, I don't mean go in mindless oblivion. When I say go in peace, I don't mean go without challenging yourself or others. When I say go in peace, I don't mean go in utter ease and comfort. When I say go in peace, I mean go in peace seeking justice. I mean go in peace, committed to equal rights and opportunities for all. When I say go in peace, I mean go in the peace that is created when together we build communities of true solidarity, deep compassion, and fierce, unrelenting love. Go in peace.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter and the podcast used in its entirety. This permission can be obtained by emailing unitarianSA@bigpond.com. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching SA Unitarians.